This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Proxy by Alex London. Read by Andrew Sweeney. Both were being denied their childhoods. The prince by a smothering excess of privilege. The whipping boy by none at all. Sid Fleischman. In the landscape ahead, you will either create the software or you will be the software. Douglas Rushkoff. 1. Even a perfect machine wasn't built to go this fast. Knox knew it, but still he pressed harder on the accelerator. Ripples of heat blurred the air around the car, and the girl in the passenger seat squealed. Terror? Delight? Did it matter? He took a turn too sharply, felt the stabilizer engine straining. His windshield lit up with warnings, lane markers flashing red, speed indicators blinking. Sweat beaded on his upper lip, but the car held the road. "Are you glitched?" popped up in his data stream in translucent green letters. He could see through them to the pavement, but they were impossible to ignore. He glanced at the girl, giggling to cover her nerves. They curved up the speedway, slicing like heat lightning over the slums of the lower city, past the blast barriers and security fences, rising higher and higher. There were parts of the mountain city you just didn't go if you were Lux, parts you didn't even see. The city below them blurred. The city beside them gleamed. Knox accelerated. "Seriously?" blinked double-sized in front of Knox, each letter wiggling and changing colors. The font was chunky, the Y swished like a cat's tail. Very retro. Probably custom-made for her by some trendy, for-hire coder. Her hands waved in the air in front of the windshield, swiping out another text. "Smiley face," she added. Suddenly, her smiley face vanished. "Reduce speed. Reduce speed. Reduce speed," scrolled in front of Knox in an unfriendly industrial font. All the road signs and advertisements now said the same thing. Danger. 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 Knox waved off the augmented reality hookup. You weren't supposed to be able to turn it off, but Knox had yet to find a security system he couldn't hack. AR driving was for amateurs and accountants anyway. He gunned the car forward. The speed pressed him against the auto-cooled leather seats.
"You even know how to drive?"
the girl cried out loud, her voice shrill and excited. Knox didn't say a word. He liked to let the growl of the engine do the talking. He also couldn't remember the girl's name. Amy? Pam? Something old-fashioned. He shot her another glance, his emerald eyes flashing mischief. He smirked. That usually did the trick. She was new in Mr. Kumar's history of robotics class, a transfer from homeschooling. She liked the animations Knox hacked onto the public display on top of their teacher's scowling face. Sometimes Knox gave Mr. Kumar devil horns or a top hat, or made it look like he was lecturing them from a seedy strip club in the lower city. The girl had complimented Knox's work on her first day at school. Mr. Kumar never had any idea his image had been hacked. He just talked away from his wood-paneled office at EduCorp. He couldn't figure out why the kids always laughed so hard at his lectures. Not that he could do anything about it. They were all paying customers and could laugh all they wanted. That was a perk of going to a top-tier patron school. The customer was always right. Knox had a knack for hacking data streams, but school wasn't really his thing. He could do the work when he wanted, when he had the right motivation, but grades weren't it. A girl, any girl really, now that was good motivation. Curvy, skinny, smart, dumb, retro prep or neo-Buddhist, cause girl or party girl, it didn't matter to him. They all had something beautiful in them. He loved finding out what it was, and they loved letting him. Knox knew his assets. With a few little hacks of a hollow projection or two, a green-eyed wink and a lopsided smirk, he could get most girls to do anything. Well, almost anything. Absolutely anything would take this drive in the borrowed silver CX-30 and an after-hours tour of the patron zoo on the edge of the city. Girls loved extinct animals, didn't they? Scare them with a few hairpin turns, show them a live polar bear and some real penguins, and then cue the melting into his arms. This wasn't his first time down this road. You ready to meet a polar bear? He asked her. She giggled again. What's so funny? Polar bears were deadly creatures, carnivorous, fearless, and wild. You have to be careful around them.
Sounds like someone I know.
Me? He feigned innocence. I'm harmless as a puppy dog.
Yeah, but are you housebroken?
Oh, yes. Knox liked this one. Emily? Anne? Sue? He couldn't ask her now. If they were at one of his father's parties, he could introduce her to people, get her to say her name to the vice president of Berla Nanotech or something. But it was just the two of them in the car, and it would be just the two of them at the zoo. What did names matter, anyway? Knox didn't plan to do much talking. He swiped through his data stream, clutching the wheel with just his palms, and locked onto a holo of a long-faced puppy, its tail wagging and its little pink tongue hanging out. It bounded to her side of the windshield and licked her in 3D. She laughed. It was an old stock pick. He'd used it 1,000 times before, but it never failed him. She waved her fingers around the glowing projection in the air and tossed a text back to Knox.
Cute,
lit up on the windshield in front of him. She wasn't just talking about the puppy. Knox half smiled and bit down on his lower lip. She noticed. He was watching the road, but he knew that she had noticed.
Alice? Debbie?
Her mother was on one of those benevolent society volunteer committees. Saving the orphans or matching organ donors or something. Maybe both. They'd go well together. Her father was a mining executive for one of the big firms. Data, not dirtware. The real value was in data. He was a client of Knox's father's company, but that didn't narrow it down much. Everyone was a client of Knox's father's company. Her father was bald, right? Knox thought he remembered a shiny bald head when he'd met the man. Must be in nostalgia, like her old-fashioned name. No one with money needed to go bald. He was probably a history buff. Or was that the last girl's father? It was hard to keep these fathers and their hobbies straight. Charming fathers was so much more work than charming their daughters, with so much less reward. The girl's family must have some cred. You couldn't get into their high school without paying for it, no outside sponsors allowed. And you couldn't get eyes like hers without some serious biotech. They practically glowed purple. Her dark hair also had a hint of purple, probably designed to match. The DNA install for that kind of work must have been a nightmare for the coders who wrote it. Very lux. Knox eased on the straightaway. He was way above the suggested maximum speed, and he was way below the suggested minimum age. He'd stolen company property from his father's private lot. He'd violated the restricted speedway, violated driving regulations. He planned to do some more violating before the night was over. In the end, someone would have to pay for it. Everything costs. But really, who would set the access code to a brand new CX-30 Roadster as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and not expect his son to take it for a spin? If anyone was to blame, it was his father. Knox was 16. He was just doing what came naturally. Like the polar bears. And look where that got them.
What's so funny?
The girl asked, seeing Knox chuckle.
Just thinking about polar bears, he said, and he reached over to squeeze her thigh.
That was his first mistake. The next two came in quick succession. The car swerved slightly toward the guardrail when he took his right hand off the wheel. At that speed, on manual drive, it took both hands to keep the vehicle straight. He'd have known that if he had ever taken a manual driving class. He hadn't. He overcompensated for the swerve, jerking the wheel toward the center lane. That was his second mistake. His heart skipped a beat as he felt himself losing control. If he hadn't shut off the augmented reality driving, it would have taken over right then. These cars drove themselves if you let them. Instead, he tried to brake. Mistake number three. An alarm sounded. The car jackknifed, spun sideways, and flipped over at 162 miles per hour. Airborne. The stabilizer engine screeched helplessly at the sky. Or maybe that was the girl. He felt the car hit the ground and roll. The entire universe shattered into blinking lights and screaming metal. He heard a crunch, a snap of bone. He felt like he'd been punched in the throat. There was heat, an intense heat, and an invisible fist pulled the air out of his lungs and ripped the sound from his ears. He couldn't hear anything now, no screaming, no screeching, just the blood rushing to his head. He thought he was upside down. Twisted metal pinned his arms to his sides. He felt the urge to laugh. There was a warm wetness on his face, and he tasted something metallic. And then darkness. 2. Darkness. Nothing but darkness. What could be wrong? Sid swiped and twisted. He dragged and dropped. Still nothing. He tried resetting the power source, rebooting the software. When that failed, he tried the oldest repair trick he knew, whacking the thing with his palm. Nothing. He couldn't get a holo to project. There was just a void hanging midair in the hallway. Sid shook his head and handed the kid back the beat-up piece of plastic he used as his data stream projector. There's no connection between the projector and your biofeed. No input. Broken beyond repair. The boy didn't deign to take the small device back, even though it belonged to him.
So, like, what? You're saying you can't fix it?
I'm saying no one can fix it. It's not picking up your signal anymore. Could be the receiver. Could be that you aren't transmitting anything to receive. Sid looked down at the kid, some snot-nosed first year, zip-pocked and sneering, trying to look tough because he figured he was being scammed. Probably not a bad assumption to make, but Sid wasn't scamming him. Life in the Valve was hard enough without everyone trying to get one over on everybody else all the time, even in high school. EduCorp scammed the teachers scammed the students scammed each other. Maybe somebody learned something along the way, maybe not, but everybody paid. Sid was just trying to get his certificate and get out without owing anybody else anything. The kid's lip quivered. Exams were coming up for the first years, the kid whined. How was he supposed to get through them with no data stream access? He couldn't afford a new biofeed install. He already had 18 years of debt, he said, and he'd just started high school. Blood work costs, what, another 3 years at least?
What am I supposed to do? He pleaded. I've already been volunteered for 2 weeks of swamp drainage because of a stupid prank my patron pulled.
He went on whining. He needed new malaria meds and sunblocker patches. Probably another 6 months of debt right there. He couldn't pay for new software in his blood on top of all that. He'd have to repeat the whole year at full price if he didn't make the tests.
Bribe the test proctor? Sid suggested.
Half the kids did that. Some of them didn't even show up at all, just paid for their grades. Easy to do if you didn't mind borrowing the credit. Credit was easy. Studying was hard. The kid made a face like he'd been hit in the stomach. No go on the bribe. Sid felt for the kid. He couldn't afford to bribe the teachers either. Not without borrowing himself into oblivion or starving himself to death. The floodgates broke. The kid wept, standing in the green, tiled hallways of Vocation High School 4. His shoulders shook and he buried his face in his hands. Sid stared at the wet armpit circles on the kid's shirt. The climate control was out again. Nothing smelled worse than 3,000 sweating teenagers trapped in a concrete bunker of a building made for half that number. The valve was at the lowest point in the mountain city, where the wet heat lingered, unmoved by the breezes that kept the peaks of the upper city comfortable. Breezes were for people who could afford them. All the lower city kids got was the heat of nature's indifference. Other kids stared at Sid as they passed, shaking their heads, rolling their eyes, whispering to each other, shoulder bump after shoulder bump. Sid ran his hand through his short hair and his fingers tapped absently on the birthmark behind his ear. The mark was changing. He'd had it as long as he could remember, but in the last few months it had been growing, little black dot by little black dot, like pixels. The dots had formed shapes, four of them, darkening day by day. He worried that maybe it wasn't a birthmark. Maybe it was cancer, or plague blemishes. Were those a thing? He didn't know, but he couldn't afford to have a cancer patch installed to correct it. Talk about debt. Medical installs cost a fortune. At least, medical installs that wouldn't make you sicker than you already were. Sid had more to worry about than this crying first year in his broken data stream. Advos based on the kid's purchase profile flashed on the walls around them. Some off-brand acne care called Puss Popper, and three flavors of Fiberizer diet supplements from Epicure Incorporated. Hey, your advos are still working. Sid pointed at the wall where the advertisements were displayed. At least your bio feed is still broadcasting.
Those aren't mine. The kid denied it. Of course he denied it.
This was not helping Sid with his image. The advos were linked to your bio feed, read off the scanners that picked up everyone's background radiation. If you had a bio feed installed in your blood, and everyone in the Mountain City did, then your advos belonged to you and you alone. Your body was networked. If those advos weren't the kids, that'd mean that they were Sid's.
Sid did not want everyone thinking he needed pus poppers or fiberizer diet supplements.
These advos were so not his. Sid kept his purchase profile boring. Most of the sales pitches he saw was for dehydrated noodles, original sodium flavor. He didn't like to make it easy on the predictive marketing software. He bought as little as possible and used the black market whenever he could. Of course, the black market sold its data upstream to the legit companies too, but they didn't care if the data was accurate or not. They got the same price for a lie as they did for the truth. Everything costs.
You could just drop out.
Sid tried to stop the kids crying. Go to the recycling yards, work as a runner, or join the rebooters to fight the system. Sid held up his fist in mock solidarity. Bring on the Jubilee. The kid shook his head.
Guess you're not a cause head, said Sid, lowering his fist. He couldn't blame the kid.
Sid didn't believe in all that Jubilee stuff either. Universal debt forgiveness was a pipe dream, and the rebooters were a bunch of losers living out in the wastelands, eating rats and waiting for their debtor's messiah or something. Even their corporate terrorism was laughable. When they blew up a data center, three more went online in its place. When they trashed a protein depot, the price of food went up for everyone and Epicure hit record profits. Rebooter anti-market actions had been integrated into the market. There was no changing the system. Best you could do was get yourself clear of it any way possible.
You could sell an eye for hard cash, Sid suggested. Sell a kidney? One of the dupe organs anyway.
That suggestion only made things worse. The kid blew a loud blast of tear snot and wiped it on his sleeve. Charming.
Calm down, Sid groaned,
a trickle of sweat running down between his shoulder blades. The small of his back felt like a swamp.
I was kidding.
He put his hand on the kid's shoulder because what else was he supposed to do? The boy lowered his hands from his face. Sid stooped to look the kid right in the eyes.
What's your name?
He asked.
Tom, the kid sniffed. Tom Sawyer.
Tom Sawyer. Of course. The name said it all. A refugee and an orphan renamed from a database. Probably a West Coaster by the sound of his accent. No wonder he had all that debt. It came with the name. The Benevolent Society charged 10 years for a rescue from the desert, and another 3 for installing the data stream into your blood. 3 more years got tacked on for foster care, and 2 more just to get into school. That made 18 altogether. Sid knew that 18 years of debt well. He had it himself. Sid sighed. Why was he such a sucker for these charity cases? He was a charity case himself. 16 years old and 18 years in debt to the Zelon Corporation. Once you got so deep into debt, it was almost impossible to get out. Civilization wasn't free. But it was better than the alternative. Better than life in the swamps or the desert or the ruins of some squatter city out in the Badlands. Better than going freelance, out of the system, scrounging in the dumps for recycling, working a corner for the Synthaline gangs, or in a hacker farm. Going blind writing cut-rate codes for the Maze Gang. It sure beat getting rolled for your organs, used as meatware. Some would consider Sid lucky. He had access to credit. He got to be in school. He got to be out of the hustle, if he chose, if he wanted to take on the debt. His problem was, he didn't want to. Egan, his best friend, the one guy he trusted in the whole damn city, had like 30 or 40 years of debt by now. He was always buying the newest bio patch, updating himself with new eye colors or hair colors or skin colors, buying data-enabled contact lenses from the upper city, tiny projectors that slid under his fingernails, crazy climate-controlled clothing. He went out all the time, too, got girls presents, and did whatever designer patch was popular with the patron kids up above. Egan didn't care. His patron was a saint, never got in trouble. Egan never had to do hard labor. He never got hit with an EMD stick. He never had to teach his patron a lesson about responsibility. Sid wasn't so lucky. He'd missed more non-refundable school days for volunteer work, Zelon corporate code for forced labor, than anybody else in his class. He felt like he'd hauled every ton of cement in the Hayek Memorial Dam up the mountain by himself, and single-handedly ripped all the copper wire from all of old Denver. He figured his was the worst patron anyone had ever had in all of history. But that was the system. Patrons owned the debt and proxies took their punishments. A simple contract, a free market. Debts had to be paid. The volunteer work built Sid's muscles up so that he didn't have to worry so much about Maze Gang thugs giving him a beating, but it was hell on his knees. He'd been hit with an EMD stick more times than he could count. Electromuscular disruption fried your nerves, but you could endure anything once you got used to it. By now, Sid was very used to it. Still, just 2 more years of debt and Sid would be no one's proxy, his own man. The thought pulled him through. Soon he'd never have to owe anybody anything, ever again. He worked in the back of an illegal repair shop in the Valve, and he studied hard, and he avoided the corners and the dumps and whatever new schemes Egan cooked up. He put in his time with his head down. For friends he had Egan, and dating wasn't even a remote possibility. Not for him, not in the Valve. Easier to keep to himself. And yet, Sid knew he wasn't going to let Tom Sawyer drop out because of a busted biofeed. He could never say no to someone desperate. Sid was a sucker. "All right, Tom," he sighed. "Just get through the day, okay?" He dropped the projector into the boy's shaking hands. His fingertips left sweaty smudge marks on the cheap plastic. "You know Mr. Baram's shop, down by the runoff?" Tom shook his head. Sid rolled his eyes, but brought up his data stream again.
"Utiliboots! Give your other boots the boot!"
an Advo squawked.
"Now with burn retardant dura..."
He swiped the Advo away and brought up a holo of the entire mountain city, with the swirling roads and private communities of the upper city blurred out. Wouldn't want undesirables learning their way around. The chaotic jumble of the lower city appeared in perfect detail. He zoomed in on the shop near the dried-up river in the heart of the Valve.
"Meet me there after school," he said. "Maybe I can rig something up to get you back on the data stream for a while."
Tom smiled, and for a second Sid was afraid the boy was going to give him a hug, but he ran off to class instead, and Sid stood alone in the middle of the emptying hall, sweating by himself. Advos for hair products and the newest holo games flashed at the edge of his vision. He watched through the glowing map floating in the middle of the hallway as Tom disappeared around the corner. And then, without him doing a thing, the map vanished and a message appeared.
"Report immediately to the school aid station."
Sid stared at the words. The aid station. Maybe he really was sick. His fingers absently went to the birthmark behind his ear again. It sat on that lump of bone where his ear met his skull, and he found the thumping sound calming. He didn't feel sick. He felt fine. Other than the fear of slow, painful death from some undiagnosed disease, he felt fine.
"Report immediately to the school aid station,"
flashed again in front of him. This time he noticed the logo of the Zelon Corporation in the hologram. He reached up and swiped the projection out of the air. This wasn't about his health. This was about his patron. What had the brat done this time?
3.
"You're late, Mr. Carton."
Mr. Thompson's face glowered from the holo projected on top of the bot at the front of the classroom.
Sid
stared up at it as it rolled toward him. He swayed on his feet and rubbed his arm where the bot at the aid station had shoved a needle in. He shuddered at the memory. He really hated needles.
"Is hardly an excuse," Mr. Thompson snapped. "Do you expect the entire district to wait for you?"
"No, sir," Sid muttered, knowing that his words were being broadcast to 4 other classrooms across the lower city at the same time.
There were about 50 kids in each one, which meant he was being called out in front of 200 people. So much for keeping his head down.
"I was at the aid station. I had to give blood."
"So we are all to be punished for your obligations,"
Mr. Thompson demanded.
No, sir. Sid wobbled. He worried he was going to pass out. He was having trouble focusing. They'd taken a lot of blood.
The aid station bot hadn't explained why he had to give blood, just that he did, or he would be in violation of his debt contract. The blood was required of him. That was the only answer he could get, but it was from an official Xelon data stream, so he had to obey. The aid station bot also had EMD capabilities. He'd prefer a simple blood donation to an EMD blast any day. So he'd closed his eyes, looked away as the needle went in, as his blood flowed through a tube into the medical bot. He'd heard the term blood debt, but he'd never had to donate blood to his patron before. He always thought blood debt was some sort of historical thing. Why should his blood pay a debt?
Then again, why shouldn't it?
Value is in the eye of the creditor, as they say. The debt paid, the bot let him stagger his way to class, and now that he was there, he just wanted to sit down and be left alone.
It won't happen again, he mumbled, and rushed to take his seat.
See that it doesn't, or it'll be a fine on your account.
The holo of Mr. Thompson's face followed him as he crossed the room. The bot was an old teaching model, but their school didn't get Lux equipment for anything. Mr. Thompson was probably in an office somewhere in the upper city, in front of a bank of monitors, enjoying the climate control and the fact that he would never have to meet his students in person. The bot was 7 feet tall and sat on a large swivel ball that made it maneuverable in any direction and impossible to tip over. It had multiple channels of video and sound to pick up the whole room, though half of them were jammed with simple jabber apps. There was also a transmitter for uploading and downloading from the students' data streams. And that was a lot harder to jam. EduCorp proprietary software. Interference with biodata transmission was punishable by hard labor and 6 additional months of debt for each count. No one bothered with those hacks. The crime was not worth the punishment. Once Sid sat, the bot went back to pacing, rolling over the tile with a mechanical purr and a disconcerting click where the tiles weren't level. It would be pacing the same way in all the classrooms where Mr. Thompson taught. He probably had it on an auto-pacing program designed for dynamic instruction to meet the developmental needs of the modern vocational student. Educational jargon. Sid had read the manual. Sid had read all the manuals. His boss at the shop where he worked bought them off the black market, so Sid would know how to repair or modify anything that came in. It wasn't technically legal, but the valve security companies looked the other way. Every business in the valve broke some regulation or another. It was the only way to survive. As long as it was only small rules being broken, no one cared. If you lived in the valve, lawlessness wasn't a vice, it was a life skill. Sid's transmitter vibrated the moment he sat down. He tapped it and brought up a tiny projection on the palm of his hand, small enough that only he could see it.
Blood?
Egan's text popped up in his cupped hand. They messed with their spelling so the EduCorp wordworm didn't pick up on their conversation. Sid looked up at Egan and shrugged. Egan fired another text off, and Sid looked down at it.
Your patron equals ass.
Egan shook his head, sympathetic. Sid didn't disagree. Egan changed the subject.
What's with the Sandrat? Sawyer? New BF?
Sandrat. That's what they called the West Coasters and anyone from the lowlands around the mountain city. There was no civilization left out there, just desert sand and festering refugee camps. To the east were the pestilential swamps and the radioactive cities. They couldn't even support refugee camps. If you came from the east, you were a swamp cat, like Sid.
Why, you jealous?
Sid texted back. He ignored Egan's Sandrat comment. They'd been friends forever, though lately it seemed like they had a lot more history than current events. Egan was always tweaked on something.
You wish.
Egan's eyes flickered. He didn't use a projection. He got his data stream from contact lenses, right against the eye. Very Lux. Private projectors did not come cheap, and with these lenses, you couldn't even tell Egan was getting data, except that he blinked more than usual, and his eyes didn't seem to focus on anything. Although Egan's eyes never seemed to focus on anything anyway, lenses or no, a side effect of Synthylene. Or maybe its intended effect.
You're not my type, Sid replied. Too skinny. Still crushing on Atticus Finch?
Shut up, Sid swiped.
Ooh la la, he's so handsome. You want to kiss with him?
Atticus Finch, a sand rat who was going places, a skilled gamer with sponsors and everything. He wouldn't be living in the Vow for long, and it didn't hurt that he was easy on the eyes.
IMD, Sid replied. Mega TMI.
Unauthorized text
flashed across the palm of Sid's hand, and suddenly he was staring at Mr. Thompson's face, hovering in front of his fingers. Egan flinched. He'd just gotten an eyeful of the old coot. Thompson could multitask, that was true. He'd hacked them without stopping his lesson for a second. Sid looked up from the teacher's face in his palm and saw that he was staring down at them from the holo on his bot, too. Double faces glowering at Sid and Egan.
There is an old saying, gentlemen, Mr. Thompson declared. It goes, secrets, secrets are no fun. Secrets, secrets come undone.
Suddenly, their brief conversation went public, projected into every data stream in the class, in all five classrooms across the city. Kids he'd never meet, never would meet, were reading Sid's text with his best friend. Years of keeping his head down, gone in a flash of data, just like that, instantaneous. Egan shrugged it off, but Sid turned rust red. Kids glanced back at him, muttering, their own authorized text pouring out in torrents. He saw a dozen hands drop down, colors in their palms as covert holo projections exploded with the new info. A handheld light show of Sid's humiliation.
Projections on desks, please!
Mr. Thompson barked, and the palm-sized glows rose and flattened onto the tables in front of each kid. In front of the room, Atticus Finch kept raising his projection, straight over his head. He glanced back at Sid, and his perfect lips sneered. On the holo above him, a message popped up in bright red, clear to Sid from across the room. It was fully spelled, wordworm be damned.
Don't look at me, you Chapter 11 punk!
Atticus put his forefinger against his thumb, and he flicked it in Sid's direction.
To you too!
Egan grunted and flicked right back, but Atticus had already turned away. Sid pressed his hands into his eyes, shutting out the world.
Chapter 11.
Slang for guys like him. A bankrupt one and one. A binary insult. Two of the same thing pressed together. The old way of saying it was homo. So much for a private life. Everyone probably suspected it already. He'd never had a girlfriend, but now they knew, right there in undeniable digital. Sid had a thing for Atticus Finch. Or at least for the idea of Atticus Finch, just like all the fangirls did. He sank into his chair. Class continued. Something about the emancipation of the working class through open credit markets, but it was boring stuff. Ancient history. Sid stewed where he sat.
Hey,
Egan whispered, not daring another text message.
Don't worry about it. Thompson's a knockoff of a man. Don't let him get to you. I'm not worried about Thompson.
Sid whispered back.
You could do better than Atticus Finch. Shut up, okay? I guess you like him dumb, huh? Just shut up. How about the sand rat with the busted projector? He open for your sort of business? You aren't helping. Relax. If anyone messes with you, you tell me. They'll regret it. You're messing with me. Other than me.
Sid sighed. He knew Egan was as good as his word. He was ruthless and always had been, but he valued loyalty above all else. He didn't care that Sid was a Chapter 11 as long as he was loyal. Egan had come to the orphanage around the same time Sid did, though Egan was local. Not a refugee, just unwanted. When they first arrived at the orphanage, they were assigned to share a sleeping compartment. It was an accident of fate, but it worked. Egan called Sid Swamp Cat until they were 8 years old. Then Sid hit a growth spurt first and punched Egan in the face. He called Sid Sid from then on. Sid had only ever called Egan by his name. They stuck together. They looked after each other and fought with each other and fought for each other. They told each other their plans and their dreams and their secrets. Some of them were even true. They were, in short, best friends. After Sid took up working and living in the shop, Egan kept freelancing for the security firms. He trashed stores that competitors were supposed to protect, stole from other people's clients, and looked out for anyone who'd come into some success and might want a little peace of mind. Sid never had a talent for that kind of commerce, and he had no interest in salvage picking or selling himself to leering old has-beens. Egan, however, didn't mind getting dirty. Blood washed off easier than poverty. Blood. Sid couldn't tell if he was lightheaded from giving away half his blood, or if he was lightheaded from shame, but he definitely needed to lie down. Instead, he stared at the public projection of the day's lesson in front of him. Thompson had moved on to the Nigerian trade embargo.
"Hey, Sid," Egan whispered again. "Sid!"
He was not about to let Sid just tune out and pass the time in peace.
"Why are you even here today?" Sid whispered back at him. "I thought you paid Thompson off every week." "It's not all about grades,"
Egan said, wrinkling his eyebrows at Sid's tone.
"And don't get snipping with me, princess. I came to school for you." "To ruin my life? To make your day,"
Egan smiled.
"Tonight, Upper City Party, Mega Lux, patrons only. Supposed to be insane. Party of the year."
"Right."
"I'm serious, it's exclusive. So how are you gonna get in?"
Egan glanced up at the robot pacing in front of the class. He leaned closer to Sid.
"You mean we? How are we going to get in?"
He smiled a fiend's smile.
"I know a patron. Guy can get me inside, and he's got a hookup for 2 ID patches that'll get us past the scanners. My treat. I've got to work." "Oh, come on! It doesn't even start until midnight. I know you're not working at midnight." "You know dancing's not really my thing,"
Sid tried, but Egan was relentless when he got an idea in his head.
"Not your thing? You ever been to a patron's party before? Everyone's beautiful, Sid. Everyone. And they don't have hang-ups like in the vow. They're Upper City. They're all like neo-humanists or something. You can be as 11 as you want to be. No one'll judge the lust of your loins."
Sid's face flushed.
"You're disgusting." "I'm desperate," said Egan. "You gotta come with me." "Why do you care so much if I'm there?" "Because girls love a Chapter 11 guy,"
he said like it was obvious.
"I need you to be my sidekick."
"Pass."
"Oh, you cannot leave me hanging. You can not."
Egan looked serious, furious. This was a matter of principle. Not going would be an unforgivable breach of Egan's unwritten contract for their friendship, signed in so much blood over so many years.
"Fine,"
Sid caved, sighing.
"Good,"
said Egan, and turned back toward the front of the classroom, acting like he was looking at the graph that Mr. Thompson had displayed on a public projection.
"Come by my place at 10, he whispered. "I'll give you clothes. You can't wear those rundown valve rags. People expect a certain standard from a homosexual." "How do you know so much about it?"
Sid smirked.
"Like I said, you wish,"
Egan smirked back.
"Just don't be late. I don't want all the girls taken by the time we get there."
Sid shut his eyes. The day just kept getting longer. Now, in addition to helping pathetic Tom Sawyer fix his broken transmitter and figuring out how to avoid Atticus Finch for the rest of his life, he had to get ready for some lux happening in the Upper City that, like all of Egan's schemes, was sure to be more trouble than it was worth.
How is it not even noon?
4. Mr. Baram's shop was on the left bank of what used to be the South Platte River. It had been dammed for a few years now. People in the valve couldn't draw their drinking water from it for free anymore, nor could they bathe or wash their clothes for free, which was kind of the point. Basic economics. Scarcity creates value. Sid's workroom bedroom was a windowless closet in the back. Not pretty, but it did have its own entrance from the alley, which he often left propped open. Mr. Baram spent a fortune on wasted coolant, but Sid liked the fresh air, even when it was hot and humid. He liked the idea of fresh air. The early evening had cooled off a bit, and a tiny, putrid breeze whipped up the garbage in the alley. Sid watched the trash dance by the open door while he put his feet up on the workbench and leaned back in the high stool. He heard the Changs arguing across the alley, shouting about the latest recycling numbers. Mrs. Chang did most of the shouting. Mr. Chang did most of the apologizing. There wasn't enough scrap metal in the world to satisfy Mrs. Chang. She had plans for her children,
and not a bit of debt, and she aimed to keep it that way.
"It's all I found," Mr. Chang said. "I tried."
"You can buy a ticket to Lagos with trying now?"
Mrs. Chang snapped.
"The Nigerians opened their border up again just for trying?" "No money, sir, but we tried." "Ha! And ask my mother if trying will treat her melanoma, eh? You want bad blood for her? You trying to kill my mother? Is that your kind of trying?" "I'll tell you, you are trying my patience is what you're trying."
Sid peered out the door and made eye contact with Mr. Chang, who smiled meekly. Mrs. Chang spat and shut their door, yelling all the while. Sid closed his eyes. His fingers ran back to the birthmark again. He rubbed it, but felt nothing. It was smooth and flat. He tapped on it, doing his own trying. He was trying not to worry about what the mark might mean, what kind of blood work he might have to buy to treat it. He was trying to make the thumping of his finger match his heartbeat. Deep breaths. Put the horrible day at school behind him. He couldn't believe the perverted hacks people had blasted into his data stream. Whenever his projector came on, some filthy image would appear, complete with hi-fi sound, and he'd have to debug and delete before the EduCorp picture peeper software noticed. Porno on the holos in school? That would mean fines for sure, and maybe a bribe to avoid getting expelled. Egan would probably be happy getting expelled. Sid, however, did not want to find himself at the mercy of the streets or Egan's neophyte criminal enterprises. He knew exactly what became of guys like him outside the system. The Advos had caught on too, trying to sell him new things to match his public humiliation. Suddenly he was seeing hair products and eyelash extenders and colognes. The Advos were as insulting as they were pointless. He didn't intend to buy any of it. He spent most of the day at school ignoring the holos and trying not to pass out from blood loss. It had been a relief to get to work. Mr. Baram gave him a juice, real fruit juice from who knows where, and his body felt better almost instantly. As for his anxious mind, there was plenty of work to keep that occupied. When the South Platte got dammed up, there had been unintended consequences. Toxic sludge pooled where the water once flowed, and pestilent mosquitoes flourished in the pools. There had been a brief outbreak of malaria, followed by a longer problem with cholera and some unidentified brain fever. Health deteriorated and debts increased. Thousands died. The squatter settlements on the banks disappeared. The consequences probably weren't unintended at all. The squatters had to go somewhere. Housing blocks, giant concrete cruciplexes were built. The squatters were rounded up and resettled. Some formed new settlements and tried to stay one step ahead of the private security companies paid to shut them down. The threat of eviction hung over everyone below. The security companies also enforced minor contracts, coerced new customers for whatever enterprise had hired them, and retrieved payment for unredeemed debts. All of these companies needed cheap parts and repairs, and that's where Mr. Brahm and Sid came in. The shop wasn't licensed, so Sid never got to fix any of the high-end stuff. He didn't really even fix anything new, but Mr. Baram's shop was the place to go to get junk working again, whether it was spider-sized scanner bots or mechanized holding cells the size of dumpsters. They'd refurbish, repair, and rebuild with no questions asked. They bought and sold parts, too, also no questions asked. Sid took care of most of the repairing, while Mr. Baram took care of the buying and selling and not asking questions. Mr. Baram also had a room off to the side where local kids who didn't go to school gamed on his old holo sets in the cool of his climate-controlled shop. Some of the kids might have even been his. No one knew for sure. He didn't charge the young ones for the hours they spent playing games. He took his payment from them in other ways. There were feral kids running around all over the Valve, and no one paid them any attention. That made them useful to Mr. Baram. He used them to gather information and to run messages, to warn him if any of the private security thugs were coming around. Everyone paid somebody for protection, and the security companies targeted each other's clients as a matter of policy. Businesses often paid three or four different gangs at the same time, but Mr. Baram paid none. He did business with everyone, and everyone needed his skills. He also had a concrete storefront with heavy bars on the windows, and a military-grade fracture cannon behind the counter. You'd need an army to lay siege to his store. As far as places to live went, it wasn't so bad at all. If it weren't for the nightmares, Sid could have slept easy inside Baram's.
Tell me something, Sidney.
Mr. Baram surprised Sid, leaning on the open door to the back alley. Sid dropped his finger from behind his ear. He didn't like revealing his personal tics. Mr. Baram raised his eyebrows for a quick instant, then took a drag on one of the expensive Upper City cigarettes he always seemed to have a carton of.
Yes, sir.
Sid took his feet off the workbench and spun around to face his boss.
Is it true you are giving away more repairs to the needy urchins of this forsaken city?
Mr. Baram chuckled to himself because he already knew the answer. He always already knew the answer.
I'll keep track of anything I use, said Sid. You can take it out of my pay.
Ah, who would I be to punish a boy for his charity?
He stubbed his cigarette out with his toe just outside the doorway. He stepped inside.
But you should keep your kindness in a harder place. You wear it in your hair, and every schnorr from here to the Upper City can smell it.
They can smell it in my hair? Sid ribbed him. Is that some kind of saying?
Mr. Baram was always making up little turns of phrase as if everyone said them. Half the time, they made no sense. He claimed his great-grandfather Amakai was a chief rabbi in the Holy Land before the wars. He claimed he had the blood of sages in his veins, and he figured if he threw some of his old language into it, it made the saying authentic.
It could be a saying, Mr. Baram declared. I just said it, didn't I? And what do you know about proverbs? Your people were goat herders in the Holy Land.
Who says my people were ever in the Holy Land? You don't know who my people were.
I don't know who my people were. No one knows who my people were. I can tell these things.
Because I'm brown?
Because, my ignorant young friend, we are kindred spirits. Somewhere long ago, I think your people were in the Holy Land. Backwards, goat-herding, idol-worshippers, but there in the mix, certainly. Why else do you think I hired you?
Because I have small hands and I don't steal.
These things are all true, Mr. Baram answered. But that doesn't make them my reasons. Perhaps not even I know my reasons.
I'm sure your reasons are as noble as your visage, Sid joked with him.
My visage, eh?
Mr. Baram chuckled.
You've been reading through my library.
You should password protect it if you don't want readers.
Oh, I want readers, my boy,
Mr. Baram sighed.
A world of readers I want, and yet all I have is you. You want information, mere data, just like everyone else. That's not reading. Wisdom. Inspiration. Pfft. Their time has passed, eh?
He waved his hands in the air.
You cannot nourish the soul with data.
You're worried about something, huh?
Sid asked. Mr. Baram only got philosophical when he was nervous.
The world being what it is, only a fool is not worried about something.
Yeah, but you're not worried about earthquakes or solar flares or Sino-Nigerian arms pacts, said Sid.
You've got a new worry. And how do you know?
Mr. Baram leaned on the table. He'd taught Sid how to cold read people, and now he was testing him.
Well, first off, you were spouting deep nonsense about the Holy Land and goat herders and nourishing the soul, which you only do when you're nervous. Second, you put your cigarette out outside, which you only do when you don't want the store to smell like smoke, which you only want when someone important is coming by. Third, you're wearing a new shirt. And fourth, you stood totally still when I said you were worried about something, and every muscle in your face froze, which was you trying not to give anything away, and which gave everything away.
Mr. Baram looked at him for a long minute. His nostrils flared and his eyes blazed. Sid thought he might get hit. It wouldn't be the first time. Mr. Baram could be moody, especially when he was nervous. But he broke out in a wide smile and put his hand on Sid's shoulder.
You've learned very well,
he laughed.
I knew you weren't a hopeless case. Ever since you were a little boy, I knew. You see, kindred spirits, Sid. My mispucha. Well done.
So what's the worry? A big deal? Something good or bad?
Good or bad, who can say until Messiah comes and all our debts are forgiven?
Mr. Baram cleaned his glasses with his shirt.
You sound like a rebooter, said Sid, praying for the forgiveness of debts.
There are worse things than forgiveness, no?
Mr. Baram shrugged.
We should all get a little forgiveness. Without it, there can be no kindness.
Kindness is expensive, Sid said.
And yet, you are going to help out this sewer boy.
Sawyer, said Sid. Tom Sawyer.
These orphan names, I'll never understand.
They get them from old books, said Sid.
I wonder if they read any of them.
Doubt it. It's just a database. Mr. Baram rolled his eyes.
So, Sidney, I gather that you are helping this Tom Sawyer with no compensation in return?
Sid shrugged. Like I said, kindness is expensive. Mr. Baram smiled.
So shines a good deed in a naughty world.
That another of your sayings? Sid asked.
Ah!
Mr. Baram threw his hands up in the air, muttering to himself.
You don't know Shakespeare!
He shook his head.
They teach you nothing in that school you pay so much for. Next time you use my library, read something beyond the dictionary. My visage.
So, what's your worry? Anything I can do to help?
Now, Sid, I don't go prying into your personal business, do I?
His tone was friendly, but he wasn't joking.
No, sir, Sid answered.
Mr. Baram nodded and went toward the inner door that led back to the rest of the shop.
Use what you need with this charity case of yours, with my blessings.
His eyes lingered on Sid for a moment, then he left the room and shut the door. Sid watched one of the holos on the wall. It showed Mr. Baram walking into the front of the shop and sitting on his usual stool with his hands resting on his belly. He looked like a lazy old man taking a nap, but he was certainly looking at his data stream on his glasses, getting feeds from informants all over the city about parts for sale and parts to buy. He could broker entire deals through his glasses without ever appearing to do a thing except blink and wiggle his fingers. Sid watched him for a while, trying to get a clue about what could have Mr. Baram on edge, when he saw Tom come in the front door and linger nervously, looking around for Sid.
Come in, Buble, come in!
Sid heard Mr. Baram's muffled voice through the door. He used his old language much more whenever a new customer came in. He called it Yiddish, and said it was a language of great history, texture, and richness, and a shame that nobody bothered with it anymore.
No, you must be Tom.
Tom nodded and said something, but it was too quiet for Sid to hear.
Welcome, welcome. You can go right through the shop back there,
Mr. Baram pointed.
You'll find Sid. You're a lucky young man. He's quite a mensch. Not a lot of those left in the world.
Tom looked as confused as a fish off the farm. Another of Mr. Baram's sayings. But he went to the door and Sid opened it for him, letting Tom into the workroom.
Leave the door cracked open a bit,
Mr. Baram called in a forced casual tone. That was his way of saying he knew about the Atticus Finch disaster at school today, and he didn't want anything untoward happening under his roof. But he'd never embarrass Sid by bringing that sort of thing up directly. Or maybe he'd known about Sid for years. Sometimes an open door was just an open door. 5.
I brought the, projector, Tom said, keeping his distance from Sid like he was contagious.
Well, you gonna give it to me?
Right, yeah,
Tom said, and pulled the small device from his tattered canvas bag. Sid took it from him and went back to his bench. The kid didn't move. The projector was smooth gray plastic, about an inch thick and 3 inches long. It had a small slot for the battery and another for the lens. The receiver in the middle picked up its owner's data stream and transmitted to the lens. This model had all kinds of problems with interference from background radiation. Even new, it hadn't been very high quality, and it was very far from new. Sid set it in a cradle and fired a laser into it. The specs popped up in a holo in the air, and he grabbed his microtools and set to work. He removed the cover and the sensor inlay. He pulled apart the processor and looked at the power supply. He studied the parts under different beams and magnifications. He tested the signal strength one more time and set the whole mess down and started to rummage for something to repair it with that might at least get Tom through exams. Tom watched him carefully, stepping up on tiptoes to see what Sid was doing, as if he'd understand. It amazed Sid how much people relied on these little devices for their data streams without having the slightest idea how they worked. The biodata everyone had installed when they were born, or in the case of the refugees when they were rescued, linked everybody to the network so that creditors and advertisers could track you. But if you wanted to use the data stream yourself, you needed your own projector. Knowing how they worked, Sid felt more like a shaman than a repairman, a keeper of wisdom and mystery. He liked the feeling. It was good to be admired for something. Everyone should feel that way sometimes, he thought. He wondered if Tom ever had. He doubted it. The kid's device was glitched beyond belief. It looked like he'd dropped it into sewage more than a few times.
I gotta look in the storage for a second, okay?
Sid stood.
I'll be right back. Don't touch anything.
Tom nodded, and Sid went down the concrete stairs next to his bench. They kept most of the parts in the basement storage room. When the hatch was closed over the stairs, you could barely see it was there, which kept things difficult for thieves or anyone else who felt like looking around. When they were in the shop, they left it open. Sid almost tumbled down it by accident every other day. Once he was down the stairs, motion sensors flicked on the LED lights, so the room didn't feel like a creepy, cluttered cellar. It was a mess, but a brightly lit mess. There were hollows on the wall where he could watch the shop from down there. He saw Mr. Baram back on his stool again, although he was slightly tilted toward the door to the workshop, keeping his eye on Sid and Tom.
As if.
Tom stood where Sid had left him, shoving his hands into his pockets and pulling them out again. He didn't know what to do with his limbs. He picked his nose. He clearly had no idea anyone could see him.
Glitched.
Sid shook his head. He rummaged through bins of glass fronts and outdated monitors, antique keyboards, some of them going back 200 years or more before the melt, before the storms, before the resource wars. They were probably worth a lot to collectors in Upper City. Baram should have an expert do an inventory sometime. Sid found robot wheel treads and cracked motherboards and leaking jars of who knew what. He found all kinds of drives and disks and cords for mismatched machines. He knew that he wouldn't find anything to save Tom's projector. It was burnt out. He could probably get it to project again, but it wouldn't pick up Tom's interface very clearly. It'd never get him through testing. Sid could always give the kid a new one, something cobbled together from all these parts. A gift. An act of kindness. What did Tom Sawyer do to deserve a gift? Sid stood in front of one bin of half-assembled transmitters and exhaled slowly, wondering how he always got himself into this kind of mess. Why did he wear his kindness in his hair, where any schnorrer could smell it? And what the hell was a schnorrer supposed to be? He laughed at himself for thinking Mr. Baram's weird saying and picked up an ancient plastic pen that had rolled out of one of the bins. He mindlessly clicked the back of it to make the little tip go in and out with a satisfying sound. Why did they even have this antique? Who knew how to write by hand anymore? He dropped the pen into his pocket out of solidarity with the total pointlessness of its survival, and he rubbed his eyes. He couldn't believe he'd agreed to go to an all-night Upper City party tonight. He just wanted to sleep and forget that today had ever happened. He lowered his hands from his face, let out a long breath. And then he froze. On the monitors, he saw Mr. Baram talking with two of the most beautiful people in the world. Their features were perfect. The woman's hair was blonde and pulled back into a tight ponytail. The man had a neat wisp of brown hair. Both had bright blue eyes like pieces of a perfect sky. They were dressed in simple, custom-made gray suits. They projected authority and inspired longing at the same time, which is exactly what they were designed to do. They were guardians, and they had come for Sid. 6. Sounds of suction and electronic pulses, beeping, blipping, clicking. Lights danced. He tried to push himself up, but thick straps pressed him to a cushioned table. His knees itched, but he couldn't scratch them. His side ached, but he couldn't touch it. He heard a screech, metal scraping metal.
Stabilize the head.
A voice said, the sound muffled.
We have some bleeding,
another said. He felt a pinch in his stomach, a wave of nausea. Suddenly, a face loomed over his, a face in a holo projection, wavering the air, translucent.
Knox? Knox?
The face said. Giant teeth. The voice bubbled, like it was underwater. Knox remembered seeing a giant fish tank once when he was little. Every few minutes, a column of bubbles would roar up and rise to the surface, smashing on the water's underside. He had pressed his ear to the tank to hear the bubbles roar. Prehistoric sharks, massive, toothy creatures, swam by his head, inches from his face. Just the glass between them, a tiny bit of plexi between life and death. He remembered his heart racing in his tiny chest. He could have stayed there for hours, listening to the bubbles, pressing his face near the shark faces swimming by, but his mother took his hand, led him to the children's area. It was a party. He remembered laughter and the chatter of grown-ups, his mother's warm hand on his back, sharks swimming around the room, the roar of bubbles echoing in his ears.
Knox, can you hear me?
The toothy face on screen was tiny next to a shark's. Time was collapsing. The shark swam in front of the face. There was no shark, just the face. Knox drifted into aching silence. Awake again. Staring straight up, he was lying on his back on that same soft table, still restrained. He was in a tube, plexi all around him, just like the shark from his dream. Sharks can't stop swimming or they'll die. Knox couldn't move, but he felt movement inside him. He wasn't the shark. He was the bubbles crashing on the surface. He heard muffled voices on the other side of the plexi, his father's voice.
Will he survive?
He's through the worst of it, said that screen voice. Knox tried to turn his head to see, but his head wouldn't turn. He was locked into some sort of brace. We've closed the punctured lung. The ribs are mending. Some ligaments need to be reattached and muscles rebuilt. He lost a piece of intestine and one ear.
We had the cells on file, so we could reattach most from his own. The liver was in sorry shape, causes beyond the accident, I think. We had a healthy one from a donor. Replaced his, gratis.
There was no need, said his father. We could have paid for the liver.
You've been so generous with our institution. It's the least we could do.
I appreciate your assistance with this.
Boys need a firm hand. He is lucky to have a father who cares so much.
Knox's father grunted.
He should be stable to transfer in a few hours, the other voice said. We're just waiting on a blood transfusion to arrive from the lower city. That should get his strength up.
Good, his father replied. Message me when he's awake.
Of course, sir.
Knox managed to twist his head to see his father. Blurry through the plexi tube. Their eyes met, and his father shook his head just once and put on his dark glasses. He turned his back and left the room without a word. Did he know Knox could see him, could hear him? Of course he knew. Knox closed his eyes, wishing he could press his face against the shark tank one more time. He saw himself, so young, on the other side of the plexi tube, his ear pressed against it, his mother's hand on his back. He missed his mother. He tried to speak to himself, to ask himself what was happening. Where was he? Why was he in this tube, restrained? Why was his father so disgusted with him? Why did everything hurt? But his voice gurgled like a column of bubbles. He saw himself run off, felt his mother's warm hand on his back as she led him through the grown-up party. Sharks swam around him, but she kept him safe with her touch. Knox slept and dreamed he was still awake. Then he woke. 7. Knox was looking at a room someplace. It hovered in a hollow at the end of his hospital bed, like a window hanging in thin air, a window into a dump. There was junk everywhere, pieces of robots and computer parts, strange tools, bits of grime in the corners. There was an old guy, Harry, talking. The volume wasn't on yet. No sound. It didn't matter. Knox didn't want to hear what he was saying. He tried to focus past the holo projection at the wood-paneled wall behind it, but the double focus made his head spin. He rolled his eyes to the ceiling. Everything ached. He felt himself drifting off to sleep again when a rush hit him. The nurse had her own holo projection up, off to the side. She tapped it, and the patch on his arm glowed as it installed whatever biodata they were using to keep him awake. The patch made everything sharper, brighter. His veins tingled with the signal shift. It would have been fun if it didn't also make his pain more vivid, like a thin knife blade stuck into his belly button. He groaned, mostly for effect.
They'd hacked his biofeed and could keep him awake as long as they wanted. They could have made the pain go away too, but they didn't. He groaned again.
"This is for your own good,"
Nox's father said with that same tone he probably used to fire people. Nox looked over at him. His father sat in a mod chair next to the hospital bed. He wore a dark suit and hid his eyes behind dark glasses so no one could tell if he was looking at them or at his data stream or both. Even out of the office, he was never away from the office. Nox felt ridiculous wearing a hospital gown while his father was in a suit and dark glasses. It struck Nox that he wasn't in a tube anymore. He was in some kind of luxe hospital room. He didn't recall being moved. Everything was hazy. A tube stretched from his arm to some sort of bag. Bright blood flowed in from the tube. A transfusion. Why did he need a transfusion? And why were they keeping him awake to look at a holo of some dumpy room filled with junk? Nox gritted his teeth and looked around. Wood panels and brass fixtures. A 3D holo on the wall looked like a window over snowy mountain peaks. Maybe the Rockies or Everest before the melt. What were those old European ones? The Alps. Hadn't they been vaporized in the war? Nox never was good in history. Whatever. The projection was Lux, whatever it was. He could smell the snow. Nox didn't know why he was in this hospital room. Something about a car. A girl named Pam. Was that it? Emily? He couldn't remember. Why was he in so much pain? He'd been having a dream about his mother and a shark tank. The nurse patted him sympathetically. She'd be pretty out of that uniform. Nice legs and good curves just above them. He winked at her. His eyelids hurt. He didn't dare try a smirk. Better to wince and get sympathy. He couldn't pull off rakish from a hospital bed, especially when he didn't know why he was there.
"Watch the projection," his father commanded without even turning to look at him. "This is all pointless if you don't watch the projection."
So that's what this was. Proxy business. What a hassle. Nox wanted to be left alone to heal. He needed his rest. He was injured. He was in pain. His punishment could wait, couldn't it? Not like his proxy was going anywhere. On the holo, two guardians stepped closer to the old man, and then one of them noticed a door cracked open in the back. They walked to it without asking permission and shoved it wide. Nox couldn't take his eyes off of them. Why guardians? He'd done a lot of crazy stuff over the years, and his proxy never got picked up by guardians. They usually just outsource this sort of thing to a local security outfit. What had he done that called for guardians? Guardians were barely even human. They'd had so much code written into their blood, their bodies were basically hardware, networked and programmed. And they were the exclusive property of Securitech. They were developed to preserve the market from terrorists, to prevent the chaos of strife and anarchy from ever returning. They were never used for picking up a proxy. It wasn't worth it. The program each one of them had installed when they were culled as children cost more than the entire economic output of the lower city.
"Kind of over the top, huh, Dad?"
Nox glanced at his father.
"Pay attention,"
his father grumbled in reply. Nox felt his breath quicken as the guardian stepped into the next room. There was his proxy now, sniveling and frightened in front of the guardians. Nox didn't remember the boy like this. He looked smaller, younger, weaker. The proxy he remembered was broad-shouldered, wore his hair short, and had skin the color of a dark beer. Maybe that kid was gone. Maybe this was a replacement. Nox had no idea if that happened. Could they just replace a proxy without notifying you? He'd sort of grown used to that other kid. Not that it mattered. He'd never know Nox. Patron confidentiality was, like, a law. But this new kid, he almost demanded punishment. That kind of defeated the purpose, no? Even without the volume on, you could tell he was whining. Nox was grateful there was no sound. His head couldn't take it. He imagined the kid's voice like a squawking penguin. Why was he thinking about penguins? Did he steal a penguin? Is that what this was about? He remembered something about the zoo. He tried to remember flapping wings, those tuxedo birds, anything at all. But there was just blankness, a hole in time. Suddenly, another figure was in the room on the screen, a boy he recognized. He rose right out of the floor. That was the boy, Nox's proxy. The kid must have a rough time of it living in the valve, if this was his house. Had he come out of a basement? Is that where the old man kept him?
Can we get some sound, please? Knox's father snapped at the nurse. This is hardly a useful exercise without sound.
Yes, sir,
said the nurse. She'd brought the sound on with a swipe of her finger. She'd been sparing Knox the volume up to that point. He'd have to get her ID before he checked out. Her hair had this amazing copper shine against her pale neck. It wasn't the fanciest jean job he'd ever seen. The color profile was just a little off, but that made it even more endearing. Of course, she worked for his father, which was a point against her.
I'm Sydney Carton, the boy on the screen said. You're looking for me?
The female guardian checked projection to get a match on his bio feed. She nodded at her partner. They had the right kid.
What is it this time? Sydney asked. Please come with us,
the female guardian said. Talk about nice curves. The guardian was amazing. The theory was that people followed the orders of an attractive person more readily than an ugly person, so all guardians were hot. They were chosen for their attractiveness. Genetically sourced was the official line. Everything else could be programmed in. Biomanipulation was a booming business, especially in the security sector. There was no shortage of threats to guard against. Smugglers, hackers, Nigerian-backed saboteurs, debt-crazed rebooters trying to overthrow the system. Some people didn't want to pay their fair share. Some people hated the prosperity of others. Knox tried to pay attention to the holo, but his mind kept wandering. He found himself thinking about a polar bear. What did that have to do with anything?
I already gave him my blood today. What else do you want?
Sydney sighed. He didn't look alarmed. He looked bored. Knox glanced at the bag of blood pouring into him and the scruffy, dark-skinned kid on the holo. He felt suddenly itchy, like the poverty of that boy was flowing through his veins now. His stomach turned.
Is that hygienic?
He asked his father.
We test the blood, Knox.
His father sounded bored, too.
Aren't you supposed to tell me what I'm being punished for?
Sydney, on the holo, said. Knox pushed himself up to lean his lower back against the headboard.
Did my patron hack another diet supplement pill? Make the steak taste like sewage or foot sweat creme brulee?
The proxy grumbled. The sniveling kid stared at the guardians, unblinking. Knox wondered what sketchy scene they'd wandered in on. Code snappers? IP thieves? Cut-rate gene rippers? Anything goes in the valve. You get the laws you can pay for and not a penny more. The guardians weren't there to enforce some petty valve crimes. The sniveling kid looked like he had never even seen guardians before. Probably hadn't, if he was lucky. The old man was suddenly back in the room, coming toward them, wagging his finger in the air.
Sydney is a good kid, he was saying. He follows the rules. You have to tell him what this is about.
The guardians turned to the old man and stared him down, stopping him in his tracks with their eyes.
These are your rules,
the old man added, much more quietly, almost to himself.
I have a terms of proxy agreement statement here somewhere.
His eyes twitched as he scanned the data stream in his glasses, projections flashing in the air in front of him. But the female guardian grabbed his wrist and bent his arm back like a mischievous child with someone else's doll. The projections vanished. The old man's eyes focused.
Sir,
the guardian spoke calmly, but with a tone that left no doubt as to who was in charge. Knox leaned forward. At least now he'd find out what he'd done. Stealing a penguin wouldn't land him in this hospital. Stealing a penguin wouldn't hurt this much. Although he'd never actually stolen a penguin that he remembered. Maybe it could. Or maybe a polar bear. Had he been that tweaked? What kind of punishment did stealing extinct animals from the zoo require of his proxy?
The proxy owes his patron a debt accrued for theft, trespassing, destruction of property,
the guardian said.
What an idiot,
Sydney muttered.
And homicide,
the guardian added.
Wait, what?
Blurted Sydney.
Wait, what?
Knox blurted with him.
Homicide?
He looked at his dad. Machines started beeping. Holo projections of his vital signs appeared all over the room.
Yes, Knox, and I hope this will teach you a lesson,
his father answered, peering over his glasses.
Marie died.
Who?
Was all Knox could muster before the world went black again. 8. It was some time later. Knox couldn't tell how long,
when that familiar drug rush of clarity and pain woke him. His father and the nurse were on either side of him, and he was staring once more at Sidney, his proxy, on the holo at the end of his bed. Knox hadn't moved, but Sidney had. He was in a tiled room, brightly lit. The proxy's skin looked almost gray under the harsh lights, and he didn't look bored anymore. He looked frightened. The picture zoomed in close on his face, probably for dramatic effect now that Knox was awake. He hated those cheap tricks. The punishments should really speak for themselves. But some case agent in some office somewhere probably had his own ideas about cinematography. The image widened to reveal that Sidney was tied up by the wrists and suspended by some sort of chain overhead. He'd been stripped down to his boxer shorts. He had a large scar on his upper arm, probably from the cheap biofeed install when he was a child. He had two more scars along one side of his rib cage, and another along his collarbone that looked like it had been sewn shut with concertina wire. Knox wondered why he didn't get the scars fixed. There were patches that could do the repair work, and they weren't even that expensive. Maybe the kid took pride in looking like a thug. Maybe that was fashionable in the Valve. The Guardians were with the proxy, flanking him. Maybe the same ones, maybe different ones. It was impossible to tell. Sidney's clothes were piled on a table in front of him, just a shirt and cargo pants. His plastic holoprojector set beside them on the table, smashed, useless. That seemed excessive to Knox, adding inconvenience to injury. What lesson could breaking the kid's data stream access possibly teach Knox?
"Sound again, please," Knox's father commanded, and the nurse brought up the volume.
All they could hear was Sid's deep breathing. No one spoke. Knox had seen his proxy punished in all sorts of ways over the years. Zapped with the EMD sticks, forced to work under the blazing sun out on the dam construction above the river, even just held alone in the dark for days. That was how the system worked. Knox's father purchased the boy's debt, and when Knox broke the rules, the boy was punished. It was a transaction, plain and simple, the cornerstone of civilization, the free market. But this, tied up, nearly naked, it was too raw, too physical. Knox wanted it to stop. "Calm down, Knox," he reminded himself. "Think clearly. It's not like anyone forced this Sidney kid to go into debt, right? Was it Knox's fault the boy had bad luck?" The proxies were randomly assigned by age group. Zelon purchased huge blocks of debt in bulk, sold and resold them automatically. Nothing personal at all. Some other kid in the Valve was probably racking up debt with some patron kid who never broke the rules. Like Duras Wen, that kiss-ass. He'd probably never even seen his proxy. Never would. His family paid and paid, and the proxy got credit for nothing. It was a gamble. Sidney had lost. It was that simple. But this time a girl had died. A girl named Marie. She died because of him. Knox still couldn't exactly remember how or why, but he'd find out. That was the deal. When his proxy was punished, Knox was forced to watch it happen. Even now, even in his hospital bed, his father sat in judgment beside him. Knox had known Sidney since they were both 4 years old, even though Sidney would never know him. The first time he saw Sidney Carton was because Knox had broken one of the ancient tablets his great-grandmother rescued from the ruined museums of the East Coast when the floodwaters rose. A stone slab with little dents and shapes in it, some contract from some long-forgotten civilization. Mesopa-something. Knox had tried to ride it down the stairs. It shattered halfway to the landing. Sidney was pulled right out of his bed in a part of the city Knox hadn't known existed. He was skinny and brown, and his hair was wild and kinky, and he didn't look anything like the other children Knox knew. Just seeing him made Knox frightened. When he was brought into the room, Knox remembered Sidney laughing. He stopped laughing when he saw the EMD stick. Sidney got 5 low-power zaps, and he obviously didn't understand why. Even when the matronly head of the orphanage explained it to him, he just cried and cried and screamed and cried some more. Knox cried right along with him. Then Knox apologized to the holo and to his father and even to the little vacuum robot he'd tried to blame for breaking the tablet. He vowed to be better, promised he'd never be a disappointment again. But that lasted about 6 weeks, until he tried to see if the vacubot could fly by throwing it off the roof. It couldn't.
For that, Sid got 10 zaps. Within a year, Sidney had stopped crying, and Knox had stopped wincing when he watched. They varied the punishments as the boys aged, but it never affected Knox like it did the first time. And Sidney seemed to take it in stride, all part of the system. But now Knox felt that old pang, that feeling he hadn't really known since that old clay tablet. He was watching the screen, and he was afraid. He felt like he was in the room with Sidney, like he was Sidney.
"Your patron has committed serious crimes," the female guardian said. "Per the terms of your contract, you will be administered the full punishment unless he files a waiver to appear in your place. Is that understood?"
Sidney didn't answer. He just looked around the room.
"Where is he?"
Sidney asked, eyes darting. No way he'd even see the cameras, but still, his glances made Knox wrap his hospital gown tighter. He hugged himself.
"His whereabouts are not your concern," the guardian said. "Do you understand why you are being punished?"
"Because my patron is a waste of meat," Sidney said. The female guardian smiled in an imitation of sympathy. She nodded, and the male guardian stepped forward with an EMD stick and put it against Sidney's side. The proxy squirmed and writhed. His feet left the floor and his toes curled. When the stick was pulled away, his head slumped forward and he gasped. He looked up again. The view zoomed in on his face. Knox wanted to close his eyes, but he wouldn't give his father the satisfaction. He wasn't in that room. He wasn't Sidney. Nothing like someone else's pain to put you back in your own body. He was here, in this room, with his own pain, and he wouldn't blink.
"Do you understand?"
the female guardian asked again. Sidney nodded.
"Good. You currently have 2 remaining years of debt to repay. We are required to give you the option to repay in full now. The current rate of exchange is 4,862 credits per month outstanding, for a total of 116,688, plus processing fees. Would you prefer to repay in full now and defer punishment?"
This was the standard script. The rates changed based on a formula only the top executives could see, but the choice was the same every time. It's either you or me. Someone's got to pay. It was pretty absurd when they were little kids. Knox didn't know what any of those words meant, and it didn't look like Sidney did either. But it was like the old religions. Repeat the prayers over and over for years and years, and only later come to understand them. Knox got worried as they got older that Sidney would say yes one of these days and buy his way out of the system. Would this be the time? He held his breath, not sure what he was hoping.
"Repay with what?"
Sidney sneered. The guardian nodded and a holo appeared in front of her. She tapped it a few times to enter the response, then vanished it with a wave of her hand. She met Sidney's eyes.
"We will administer the punishment as follows."
Knox held his breath. He was going to hear the full list of what he'd done.
"For your patron's crime of larceny of corporate property, you will receive 20 pulses at level 8.7. For the crime of trespassing and destruction of property, you will receive 40 pulses at level 12.5.
Sidney slumped where he was hanging.
"And for the crime of negligent homicide, your flesh be branded with the name of the deceased, one Marie Louise Alvarez, and you will be sent to Old Sterling Work Colony for the period of 16 years, 18 days, and 9 hours.
Sidney's head snapped up. His face showed a new expression, the lips turned down, the eyebrows collapsing toward each other.
"You can't. I only have 2 years left. Per the terms of the agreement, all policies are based on penal recommendations as defined in the current actuarial tables available through the Zelon Corporation information system at the time of contract. The compensation for the life of a patron is the equal number of years from the offender's proxy as replacement for lost productivity, as your contract clearly states." "But I was a baby when the contract was made." "The Benevolent Society enrolled you in loco parentis to repay your debts. You should have filed a formal objection at the time." "I was a baby!" "Unless your patron would care to waive his exemption, we will begin immediately." "You can't do this! Sterling! 16 years!
The silence hung heavy around the hospital room. The nurse looked at her feet. Knox could feel his father's attention shift from his data stream to his son, even without seeing his eyes. He frowned. Whatever he saw on Knox's face was more disgusting to him than the torture Sidney was enduring.
We will begin.
The guardian nodded at her colleague, who stepped forward with the EMD stick emitting a low hum that seemed to shake the image in the air. Knox winced as it got near his proxy.
Why shock me if you're just going to send me to Sterling?
Sidney squirmed where he hung, pulling his waist away from the tip of the EMD stick.
The punishments are not for you,
the guardian said without the slightest hint of emotion in her voice.
They are for your patron.
Who is he? What's his name?
Sidney yelled.
Coward! I know you're watching, you knockoff patron coward!
The first shock sent Sidney's whole body rigid, every muscle tensed. Knox could see the veins in Sidney's forehead and arms pop up. The stick was removed from his side, and he slumped again where he hung. The holos from the proxy's biofeed that hovered around the tiled room flickered. The EMD pulse disrupted his signal. It fried every nerve in his body.
One,
said the female guardian. Sidney gasped. The stick touched his side again. He flailed. His legs danced freely in the air. His neck thrashed from side to side. The holos around him flickered again.
Two,
she said. More flickers.
Three.
Knox closed his eyes. He had to. He couldn't witness this. In the oblivion, Knox saw an image of the girl. Her purple wink. Her dark hair. Her nervous laugh. He'd taken a car. He'd convinced her to come. Her name was Marie. Marie Alvarez.
Open your eyes, Knox! His father snapped at him. A rush passed through his limbs and his eyes shot open on their own. Did you realize how much this is costing me?
His father leaned forward.
My rates are going to go sky high because of this. I'll have to pay for a new proxy for you on top of this one while he's at Sterling. And you can be sure that Shao and Grace Alvarez will not let my board of directors forget about this. They are very important clients and they lost their daughter because of you. Do you understand me? This reflects on me. You reflect on me. You need to start thinking about consequences, about other people. You aren't some piece of valve trash who can act without affecting others. You are supposed to be a leader. How will the shareholders react when they hear what my son has done, huh? You hear me? You are hurting your legacy with your foolishness. Our share price is going to plummet, and it will be blamed on my reckless son, so you will watch every second of this and think about what you've done. You will not waste my time and money closing your eyes. This is your wake-up call, Knox. It is time to grow up. I will not humor you any longer.
Knox clenched his jaw. He wanted to scream out. He wanted to shut his father up. He wanted to stop the guardians and set Sidney free, but he stayed silent. He stared forward, watching the holo, and breathing loudly through his nose. Knox watched as the guardians fried his proxy's nerves over and over and over again. By number 9, Sidney had thrown up. By 11, he was glassy-eyed, his head lolling about like a zombie in a classic movie. By the last zap, he was hanging limp. His wrists were red and raw from where they rubbed against the chain that held him. A tear ran down Knox's cheek, even as he held his head stone still. For the first time since he was 4 years old and he had been told that this boy was named Sidney, and that this boy would be his proxy, and that this boy would be punished because of the old piece of clay he'd broken, Knox cried.
You are responsible for him,
his father had told him after that first punishment so many years ago.
Whatever happens to him, that is your responsibility. Do you understand?
At the time, he had nodded through his tears. He had broken the tablet. He was responsible. When it was done, his father let him fall asleep. As he drifted off, the holo zoomed in on Sidney's head, hanging limp against his chest.
Hold that image,
Knox's father said, suddenly standing. He stepped forward and poked his finger right into the image.
What was he doing?
Knox tried to focus. His father used his fingers to zoom in on Sidney's head. He put his finger up to some weird birthmark behind the proxy's ear. He leaned in close.
Get me the proxy's blood test results immediately,
he snapped at the nurse. She began working in her own projection.
I have it right here,
she said, studying the data she'd brought up.
What is it that you're looking for?
Dad, what's wrong?
Knox asked, although it came out slurred and hazy. His father turned around, looking surprised to see him there, as if Knox could be anywhere else.
Is something wrong with the blood?
His father ignored the question, asked his own.
Have you noticed that birthmark before? Has it always looked like that?
Knox couldn't remember. He never paid that much attention. Who looks at some other guy's birthmarks, especially some proxies? Knox was so tired, but he was suddenly scared. What if he'd gotten some weird disease from that proxy's blood, loaded with parasites and pollutants? Rat flu, dengue fever, brain worms. Who knew what kind of diseases lived down in the valve? They ate wild animals down there, didn't they?
Is something wrong with...
Knox tried again, but his father brought up a holo, tapped around, and suddenly, the patch on Knox's arm lit up again. His pain vanished, and he felt a glowing, cloudy peace blossom inside him.
Don't you worry about a thing, his father said. It will be taken care of.
But I... Knox started, but he couldn't hold his eyes open, couldn't even remember what he'd wanted to ask. Even with his eyes closed, he saw Sydney's face. He saw Marie's face. Their faces hung there in the void, and then the void engulfed him, and he slept. This time, he did not dream. 9. Sid shivered himself awake, every nerve raw and prickling. The echo of a nightmare shot adrenaline up his spine. He reached back to the mark behind his ear. He could never be a gambler. His finger always went right to that spot when he was nervous. It hurt to open his eyes, but it hurt to keep them closed. Slowly, his vision came into focus. A steel table leg, white tiles, bright light, a vague electric hum. The pain and the cold told him he was alive. He was still in his boxer shorts, lying on the floor of the room where they had shocked him. His pants and his shirt were bunched under his head, as if someone had wanted him to be comfortable but didn't want to spare a pillow. He felt his heart racing in his chest. He tried to slow his breathing to calm down. He lowered his hands and pressed his palms against the cold tile. He could hear shouts and screams through the walls. He guessed these were the sounds of other proxies in other rooms, enduring other punishments for other patrons. He'd never been in a prison like this before. Usually, the punishments were given wherever the bounty hunters happened to find the proxy. If hard labor had been ordered, some local security goons would just issue the summons. Failure to show up at the appointed time was a breach of contract, punishable by additional months and years of debt, and, of course, a few hits with an EMD pulse. The security firms were always liberal with those. They made the whole thing much more vengeful than these guardians had, taunting and turning the settings higher than required. Competition was fierce to get more patron business, so firms would often interrupt each other to serve the same punishment. Fights broke out. Sometimes they'd reach a settlement and the punishment got issued twice for the same debt, double payday. And if the proxy complained, well, proxies were replaceable. Using the poor to control the poor kept everyone in the valve at each other's throats and kept them from looking too far up in the direction of the skyscrapers and the private communities. The guardians rarely showed up to haul anyone off. The market preferred to keep its enforcers more invisible than that. But a girl had died. Sid couldn't believe it. His patron had actually killed someone. Sid never imagined a crime like that or a punishment like this. He'd never imagined he'd find himself here. It had to be one of those intelligence centers that Securitech ran. Enemies of the market disappeared inside them and never came out. Last year, after the rebooters hacked an insurance data stream, 2 or 3 dozen guys were pulled out of the valve in night raids, accused of anti-market terrorism and supporting the debt revolutionaries, hiding in old Detroit. The rebooters, as they called themselves, were always trying to hack corporate systems to erase data, but they never managed to inflict much damage. The network was resilient. The men who'd been rounded up in night raids disappeared into a place like this one. Their bodies started showing up in the gutters of the valve a few days later, dumped out with the rest of the upper city trash. It was an effective reminder not to upset the status quo. Sid remembered Egan laughing at one of the headless bodies lying arms akimbo on a heap of discarded processors.
"That's Dulane," he said. "The butcher who used to pay us to hunt rats and then rip us off when we brought him in."
"How do you know?" Sid had asked.
"The neck tattoo. I'll never forget that big knockoff's neck tattoo."
Egan spat on the body and the bead of saliva rolled across the purple skin of his chest.
"You don't remember the beatings he used to give us?"
Sid had shrugged. He remembered, but
but he'd developed the philosophy that it was better to forget old beatings. A grudge was just another debt owed. No way he was a rebooter, Sid said. He wasn't political. He didn't care about debt reform.
Who cares what he was or what he believed?
Egan shrugged.
Someone must have informed on him for some reason. It's not our problem.
They had walked on, but the idea stuck with Sid. Someone didn't like Dulaine and had made an accusation. It didn't matter if it was true. Truth was a commodity no one down in the Valve could afford. Protection mattered a lot more than truth, and Dulaine didn't have any. Too many enemies. Sid remembered feeling glad he didn't know anyone well enough to have enemies like Dulaine had. He'd kept to himself, private. But now, lying on the floor listening to the tortured screams of whoever it was in those other rooms, he couldn't help but consider the coincidence. The same day he agreed to help Tom, the same day his crush on Atticus Finch came to light, was the day he was taken by the Guardians. Had he formed too many connections? Reached out just far enough to get cut off? Did he have more enemies than he'd thought? Or maybe the wrong friends? No. This wasn't about him. It was his patron. It had nothing to do with Sid. That was his weakness. When he got to thinking, it always turned back on himself, his failings, his mistakes. But he didn't matter in this. He was just a body for the rich to use and to discard when it suited them. That was his place, his market niche, like they called it. He was a proxy, and his life was on loan. His forearm ached, or rather, it ached in a different way than the rest of him. He looked at it and saw the angry red welt of skin with silver metallic letters embedded in it. They'd done it. They had actually branded him. Marie Louise Alvarez, 16. His arm glistened at him. The metal letters implanted in his skin were hard and surprisingly warm to the touch. They were slick with antibacterial gel. Sid pressed the base of his hands into his eyes. Another mark on his body. The birthmark, the scars from fights and cheap vaccines, now this. Another reminder he had as much control of his skin as he did over the weather. None. Rage boiled inside him, pushing the pain in his body down. 16 more years added just like that. And in Sterling Work Colony. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. He had played by the rules mostly for his whole life. He didn't turn squatter or scavenger or freelance. He didn't hook up with the revolutionaries. He didn't care about all the rebooter stuff, deleting the debts, restoring equality to a corrupt blah, blah, blah. The sermons got tiresome. The debts were tied to the data. The data was in the blood. There was no deleting it. And the people who thought otherwise were no better than mystics praying for a hopeless deliverance. Sid could never afford idealism, and he never wanted to. He'd rather do his work and get ahead without any stupid games. The debt he had, the debt that had been forced on him for the rescue he never asked for, and the upbringing he barely got, he paid. He endured the beatings and the volunteer work and the cruelties inflicted on behalf of his upper city patron because that's how it worked. He was almost free. And then they changed the terms. They changed their policy just like that. Sterling Work Colony was a hell. Everyone knew it. Survivors told stories of brutal guards, relentless disease, and ruthless inmates. There was no escape because there was nowhere to go. The Mountain City was the only civilization on the continent. The rest was swamp and desert and ruins. Sterling was the end, a place without compassion, without even the false kindness of the free market. There was only work and death. And soon, Sidney Carton would be sent there, 16 years old and off to Sterling with the unredeemable. No. He refused. It was that simple. He was not unredeemable, and he was not a terrorist, and he was not just a body they could discard and replace to teach some patron a lesson. He was Sidney Carton, or whatever his name had been before, and he was a human being, and he wasn't just going to lay down and take this. He had to do something. He had to escape before they came to take him away. He pushed himself up and pulled on his clothes. He didn't know how, but he had to get out of the city, find some other place to live. He'd never make Lagos. Even if he could get to a coast, stow away on some kind of global shipping hovercraft, the border at Lagos was closed. The Nigerians kept their prosperity by executing illegal immigrants on sight. There wasn't room for newcomers, and, like here, there was nothing but desert around their city. Here or there, civilization wasn't an option for a fugitive. So it was the wilderness. They said no one could survive out there.
Drought, earthquakes, and storms had wrecked what the wars didn't,
and all the old cities had been abandoned or destroyed. The world was like a feral dog. It tore out its hair to get rid of its fleas, but a few clung on, digging in where the paws couldn't scratch. You step out too far, the dog will shake you off. But there had to be someone who adapted. It wouldn't be civilization like Sid knew, but it'd be something. Maybe he could hook up with some desert nomads, learn to find water in the rocks and suck nutrients from the sand. There were worse lives, he guessed. At least he'd be free. Or he could go out east, try to find where he'd come from. But the thought of hurricane winds and tropical disease gave him pause. There was a reason everyone had retreated to the mountain city long ago. There was a reason refugees clambered to get in. There were the displacement camps, of course, to the east and west, but the Benevolent Society knew everything that went on in them. If he tried to hide out there, he'd just get caught again. Other options. He could join up with the rebooters. They were supposed to be in old Detroit, living in the jungle ruins. They'd probably sell Sid to the organ harvesters as soon as look at him. What good was he to a cause he wanted no part of? Sid didn't plan to live at the mercy of anyone else's institutions ever again, not the patrons or the Benevolent Society, and not the revolutionaries. He'd had enough of institutions. They were like fire that way. Useful, but if you played with them for too long, burns were inevitable. He'd choose the nomads if he could find them, if they existed. He'd need to get an ID clone first, something to mask his biofeed to the scanners. The system of transmitters and aerial drones could track him, just like advertisers did, unless he could outwit them. With the right hacks, he could overwrite the code and bloodstream for long enough to get away, but for that he'd need Egan. Egan always knew where to get fake ID. First, he had to get out of this room, and for that he needed to use the old journeyman lie, low-tech but time-tested. He threw himself to the floor. 10.
Ugh, Sid groaned.
Ugh!
He rolled across the tiles. He writhed. The door slid open and a six-legged black metal bot entered the room. It looked like a cross between a dog and a spider. It had two barrels mounted on a swivel where the dog ears should be, and a series of cameras around its body, like spider eyes. The Arach 9 Model 6, top of the line. Their parts were only just starting to show up on the black market. Mr. Baram spoke of them with awe.
"Please tell me the nature of your difficulty," the robot asked in an oddly gentle female voice.
Sid was thrown off for an instant.
He started. "My stomach! It hurts!"
he groaned.
"I think something ruptured. I need medical assistance."
"I am fully equipped to evaluate prisoner medical emergencies. Please stand," the bot requested.
"I can't,"
he groaned. The bot approached. Sid's biodata appeared in holos in the air around it, monitoring his heart, his blood pressure, his brain waves. For a moment, he was afraid the machine could read his mind, but, like Mr. Baram said, data was not the same as reading. Once the Arach 9 was in front of him, he reached his hand underneath its armor-plated base and found the emergency reset exactly where it was supposed to be. He pressed his palm against it and mumbled a thank you to Mr. Baram and the blessings of an informal education. They'd had the manual for the Arach 9 Model 6 for months. His biodata vanished.
"Now," Sid told the bot when its active light came on again. "Program override. Recognize speech pattern alpha. Accept voice commands from this pattern only. Confirm."
"Pattern confirmed," the bot replied in its metallic default voice.
"Take me to the nearest exit," Sid told it. "Disable any resistance with non-lethal means. Confirm."
"Non-lethal? Confirmed," the bot said and walked into the hallway. Sid followed close enough to keep a hand on its back. The hallway was empty. They clattered toward a corner with a panel projecting a 3D image of a white sand beach. It was meant to be soothing. Sid was not soothed. As they neared it, the image changed to a drone's eye view of Sid and the Arachnine moving down the hall. A silent alarm had been triggered. The lights in the hallway went out. Guardians could see in the dark. Sid couldn't. He grabbed onto the bot with both hands.
"Don't lose me,"
he told it. Confirmed. They moved quickly through the dark hallway. Sid's body ached, and he struggled to keep up. He was totally blind and going on faith that the Arachnine hadn't been linked back to the network to lead him right into a trap. That's what he would do if he were trying to catch himself right now. The Guardian's plan, however, was much simpler.
"Stop!"
a female Guardian commanded from up ahead. A panel behind her lit up brightly, framing her in silhouette. A half dozen more identical silhouettes appeared next to her, all of them armed.
"You are in breach of contract," the Guardian said, "and you have vandalized company property."
Sid heard the hum of EMD sticks charging up. The silhouettes raised their weapons. Sid braced for the painful convulsions. They never came. The Arachnine fired thick foam from its cannons, which flooded the hallway and surrounded the Guardians. The foam hardened instantly and absorbed the charge from their EMD blasts. The robot moved past the mountain of foam and headed toward the exit. Within minutes, they were outside. It was night, and the neon glow of the upper city shined just beyond the high walls of the compound. The upper offices would have a clear view down into the center. Sid shuddered to think at the things those office workers could see, the things they learned to ignore. Sid's bot fired sonic blasts up to the guard towers that stood silhouetted against the neon lights. He heard the screams of Guardians as they were hit with a wall of concentrated vibrations, enough to shatter their perfectly designed eardrums. Male and female Guardians rolled on the ground in anguish ahead of him. His new toy had disabled every living thing in their path. He didn't even hear so much as a ringing. This thing knew how to aim. He liked having his own bot. Maybe he could bring it with him into his new life, like a pet and a bodyguard all in one, the way people used to keep dogs. He'd need some company anyway. He wasn't about to ask Egan to go on the run with him. He wouldn't want to make his friend turn him down.
"Let's go,"
he told the bot.
"Exit."
"Confirmed."
The robot charged across a clearing toward a concrete blast barrier with a steel gate. He hoped this bot had a way to get through. The gate was designed to withstand mechanized assault. Half a dozen combat robots raced after them, firing their own blasts at Sid. As the dirt kicked up around him and the shockwaves nearly knocked him off his feet, he realized that they were not using non-lethal weapons. They weren't shooting to incapacitate him. They were shooting to kill.
"Focus," he told himself.
No time to think about dying. This was a time to think about living, about staying alive. At least five of the other Arachnines were closing in. He would never make it to the gate in time, let alone through it. He jumped onto his bot's back. He was going way beyond the instruction manual now, but it was his only hope.
"Leap over the obstruction," he yelled.
"Leap confirmed."
The bot responded, bent its six legs, and sprang into the air. The ground beneath them exploded with blasts from the other bots. He shut his eyes as they flew over the wall. He didn't know how well this model would handle impact on the other side. He braced himself. They hit the ground with a jarring crunch that jolted Sid off the bot's back and knocked the wind out of him. His bot seemed undamaged. Sid stood to get back on, but he saw the other bots leaping over the wall after them.
"Damn,"
he panted, and glanced to the tall buildings around him. He hoped the lower floors were empty, given what he was about to do.
"Confirm full core destruct. 5-second delay."
"Full core destruct confirmed,"
the bot said, as the others landed around them in a circle.
"Meltdown with 5-second delay."
They didn't teach this in Mr. Thompson's robotics class.
"Sorry, pal,"
Sid muttered, patting the machine on the back. Then he crawled under it and curled into a ball. He hoped he was right, that the center of the blast radius from the full nuclear core meltdown would be safe, like the eye of a storm in a hurricane. The other bots tightened in around him, surrounded.
5, 4.
He covered his head with his hands. He squeezed his eyes shut. The whole system worked on background radiation. So the explosion from a combat bot's core meltdown should vaporize every machine in a 50-yard radius and disable every network in 500 yards. He'd get a head start and he'd inflict some serious damage on the way out. He just hoped the explosion wouldn't kill him in the process. He'd never even had his first kiss.
3, 2, 1.
11. The mountains were dark against an impossibly star-studded sky. The Milky Way made a smudge over the horizon. So it was supposed to be night. Knox hit a button on the bed and the 3D mountain scene was replaced with a large digital display. 11:43 p.m., 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Air quality index, 97. Funny, he thought. It wasn't even midnight. It felt later. He took a deep breath. His ribs didn't hurt anymore. His head didn't ache. The biotech they'd been pumping into him must be top-notch to work so quickly. He looked under his hospital gown, relieved to see that he was still all there. He wasn't even bruised. To tell the truth, he felt pretty good. Energized, revitalized. But bored. He tapped his projector on the table beside the bed, brought up a holo for entertainment. He swiped through the menus. Sports and movies and short comedy and long comedy, and reality drama and reality comedy and reality classics and news. Boring, 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 and boring. He chewed his nails and spat the little flakes onto the sheets. An image popped into his head, uninvited, of Sydney hanging on that chain, screaming. He looked up, like right into the hospital room, it seemed, right into Knox. Except it wasn't Sydney's face, it was Knox's. His own green eyes sliced into him. Marie, his own face said. He bit down through his nail and the pain cleared his head. He flipped the holo again to a different menu to see what his friends were up to. Graydon. Grounded. At home with fam. Simeone. Killer party at Arcadia. Very retro. 9.
At Arcadia with Simeon Cheyenne. Detroit chic tight.
Cheyenne.
Crazy trip.
So everyone was at Arcadia, and Cheyenne was tweaked on something. Knox sighed. That party was supposed to be Lux. Someone had found all these retro cars that ran on gas and parked them all in a giant warehouse end to end, so they were like the floor of the place, with all the roofs and hoods and open-top convertibles forming a crazy desert of dunes and craters. A few of the cars actually ran so that the whole place smelled like classic fumes. It must have cost a fortune to get the antique gas from scavengers. Everyone wanted into this party, and Knox's friend Nine could make it happen for a price. Nine's father was some big piracy consultant, so he knew everyone in the entertainment business. Nine and Knox had spent a month making fake ID patches to sell to kids from all over the city. Upper, lower, whatever, even the Valve, if they could pay. They'd been making some serious credit, although Nine claimed that wasn't why he did it. He said he was curating the party, making sure it wasn't just the same old upper city bores. Knox couldn't believe he was missing this scene. He swiped the holo to a bright beach, impossibly white sand. No sludge or washed up flotsam, the sun burning white hot in a clear blue sky. He lay back on his pillow. He wasn't tired. He didn't want to lie here thinking all night. Thinking was the worst thing he could do. His door slid open and a tall Metabot came rolling in, its white porcelain body glowing delicately in the dim room.
You are awake, Mr. Brindle,
the robot's sweet female voice said.
You have one message from your father. Would you like me to play it?
Where's that nurse? Knox asked. If he was stuck here, he might as well have some fun.
Nurse Bovary is no longer in the building.
Bovary, Knox snorted. An orphan.
He wished she'd stuck around.
He could have shown her what it was like to live like a patron, at least for an hour.
When does she come back?
Knox hoped it would be soon.
Nurse Bovary has resigned her position,
the bot informed him. Knox sighed. The workers just came and went like breezes.
Would you like to play the message from your father?
He's not here either, Knox asked.
Your father left the hospital at 8:42 p.m.,
the bot said. Of course. That must have been minutes after Knox fell asleep. Seconds. What did his father care? He was an important man with real responsibilities. Knox would never understand the pressures his business entailed. It was time for him to grow up. How many times had he heard that speech? His father didn't need to work so much. Security was the perfect business.
No one could ever have enough of it. He just liked working, liked avoiding Knox. Knox had his mother's eyes. His father didn't like the reminder.
"Right back at you, Dad," Knox said aloud.
"Screw it," he thought. "If my father doesn't need to stick around for his only son, then his only son doesn't need to stick around for him."
"Delete message," Knox told the machine.
"You have not listened to the message. Please confirm."
"Confirmed. Delete the message. And bring my clothes."
"Your clothes were burned in the accident."
Knox rolled his eyes. The textbooks could ramble about the benefits to efficiency brought by robotics and the emancipation of the proletariat from menial labor. But there was something irreplaceable about employees you could flirt with.
"Access my profile and bring me some other clothes that I'd like," he groaned. "Something for going out. Retro blue collar."
"I am unsure of the nature of this request," the robot said.
"Like old Detroit," Knox sighed. "Just scan my profile pics or something, okay? And bring me some data stream glasses."
"Confirmed, Mr. Brindle."
The robot rolled back out of the room.
"Retro glasses!"
he called out after the bot. He didn't want to show up to the party of the year accessing his data stream on glasses that didn't fit the theme. He hoped the bot understood his needs. Knox put his hands behind his head and looked up at the false sun on his holo. Arcadia was just what he needed. Collect his cut from Nine, get some of whatever Cheyenne was holding, clear his head out, dance, maybe find a lower city chick to get crazy with, or two. In a few hours, he'd be normal again, and he wouldn't have to think about his proxy or that girl, whatever her name was. He let out a slow breath. He knew perfectly well what her name was. Marie. He saw her black hair, the purple shine of her eyes, the insouciant laugh, the scream as she died. He remembered it all. Tonight, he'd do his best to forget. 12.
Whee!
The sound rang in Sid's ears. The blast had worked. Cold hunks of metal littered the ground around him, still smoking. He lay in a small crater beneath the Arachnine's sizzling heat shield. It was all that remained of his machine. He checked himself for wounds. His shirt was slightly singed, but otherwise he was unharmed. He'd probably exposed himself to all kinds of unhealthy waves and ions and whatever, but he didn't have to worry about that for now. The whole valve was a cancer cluster anyway, and Sid's life expectancy was less than an hour if he didn't find a way to get lost, and soon. Every lower window of every building around him was shattered. The rebooters would no doubt take credit for this attack as soon as they found out about it. It'd give Securitech the perfect excuse for another roundup of undesirables. The farther he could get from the city before that happened, the better. He jumped to his feet and stumbled through the sanitized streets of commercial office towers, trying to stay close to the tall buildings and hoping their electrical output would hide his signal. Hulking broom trucks zipped past, programmed to clean away any evidence of human filth. He ducked behind the concrete blast barriers, just in case he fit that category. Sid crossed out of the commercial district and slid under a gap in the fence at the edge of the valve. Glass and metal gave way to broken concrete, strewn with garbage. The streets were narrow and twisting. Everything that could be used had been taken up, turned into a structure or a product. Wires crisscrossed over the lanes in huge jumbles, with hundreds of unlicensed branches tapping off the main lines. Shacks had been fashioned out of old packaging, heaps of projector parts, and solidified industrial runoff. It was a neighborhood where nothing was wasted. Starved kids rummaged through piles of refuse. They eyed Sid greedily as he passed by. Nothing wasted except the people, Sid thought. Puddles of post-industrial gel burned on the corners, turning to bricks. Synthylene dealers gestured back and forth to one another, passing patches hand to hand. Tweaked-out junkies sprawled on trash heaps, the code running through their blood rattling their DNA. Hair fell out, tattoos appeared and vanished. All kinds of havoc wrought from the lowest-grade biopatches you could find. The sight was sickening. Willful mutation. The advertisements hovering around them quivered. Sid's system was so messed up from the blast, every ad he passed was for gum. He'd never actually chewed gum in his life.
Further on, old gamers sat on piles of junk playing ancient handhelds across from each other, their networks so dodgy that their knees had to touch, just a multiplayer like they did when they were kids. Tattoo-covered thugs from the Maze Gang radiated threat from the doorways to the speakeasy bars and members-only clubs. They, too, eyed Sid as he passed. Rumor had it that to be a part of the Maze Gang, you had to kill a patron. No way that could be true. If patrons started getting murdered, they'd bulldoze the whole valve. But still, Maze Guys had a reputation for brutality, and Sid picked up his pace, avoided eye contact. Double-wides with shades drawn and electropop blaring, half-dressed women and outdated personal pleasure bots called out to Sid. Their lips moved, but to him it was all pantomime. He couldn't hear a word. He staggered up to the cruciplex where Egan lived, a 150-story bunker of a building with four wings like a giant plus sign. There were patches of concrete tucked into ground level at each corner, which the architects originally meant to be communal gathering places for the thousands of low-rent units. But people started throwing their trash down there, and no one ever paid to have it picked up. Only the garbage pickers waded in to battle the sludge-hardened vermin that lived and died in the mountains of waste. Sometimes a picker caught one of the rodents and ate well that night. Sometimes it went the other way. The smell was awful. Egan had an abnormal pride in his basement unit, even though it was no bigger than Sid's workroom off the back of Mr. Barham's shop, and didn't have any way to get fresh air. It always smelled like feet.
When Sid opened the door, Egan pulled a knife on him.
It was a soldier's antique blade that Egan had stolen from Mr. Barham's when they were little kids. He'd learned to throw it and spin it on his palm so that he could impress girls and older boys. He kept the blade sharp and shining, and Sid really wished its tip weren't touching his throat. He made eye contact with Egan, who asked a question that Sid couldn't make out through the ringing in his ears. Sid blinked. Egan smirked and pulled the knife away, looked up and down the hallway, and then yanked Sid inside. The narrow room had tin walls that Egan had covered with 3D projections showing music holos, violent retro nature shows, and weird abstract images on a 24/7 loop. He said it calmed him. It didn't hurt that the combination of signals and metal walls made low-end electronic surveillance difficult. Any private security firm that was after Egan, for whatever his latest offense was, would have to go door-to-door the old-fashioned way, and Egan knew that he wasn't worth it. He was an expert at staying on the right side of a cost-benefit analysis. Sid threw himself down on the black synthetic fur couch that Egan said he won playing dominoes. He rubbed his eyes. Was it still Friday? The guardians were after him, and aerial drones were no doubt cruising above the valve with all kinds of sensors. Their equipment was designed to find people no matter where they were hiding, even in the massive cruciplexes below. They couldn't have a proxy-breaking contract. Others might get ideas. And if contracts couldn't be enforced, the system would collapse. Contractual agreements, they all learned from the first day of school, were all that stood between civilization and a return to the age of chaos. Trying to delete a debt was like trying to destroy the world. Sid was screwed.
What the hell happened to you?
Sid finally made out Egan's voice through the buzz in his head. Egan handed him a bottle of water.
You look like a truck ran over you. And you're late. I went to all the trouble of making this awesome retro outfit for you, and what thanks do I get? None. Punctuality. Punctuality, my friend, is the hallmark of civilization.
He gestured too broadly for the small space, laughing. He was tweaked on something.
What do you think?
He pointed to the shiny black jumpsuit with all kinds of straps and buckles hanging off of it. It had a patch glued onto it that said Ed's Auto Repair. The name kept changing colors through the entire rainbow.
I thought the rainbow was a nice touch. Took me an hour to get it right, he added. It's fine. Listen,
Sid started.
Fine! Fine!
Egan leaned down on the couch, towering over Sid.
Fine? I am an artist. There are three different kinds of synthetic pheromones in that outfit. Hell, I'm almost turned on. And you didn't even see the vintage baseball cap to go with it.
He held up a black baseball cap with a white D on it. It looked like it had been rolled over by an armored assault vehicle.
That's an authentic hat! The Detroit Tigers.
They're more extinct than real tigers. Don't ask how I got it. And all you've got is, it's fine, unacceptable, unbelievable, whateverable. You are a terrible sidekick.
Egan started laughing again. His mood was swinging under the drug, and Sid had to try to keep up. Between swells of laughter, Egan moved Sid over so he could sit on the couch next to him.
Seriously, okay,
his friend cleared his throat.
What the hell is going on?
Sid told him everything that had happened from the moment he was arrested at Mr. Baram's. Egan nodded and smirked a bit when Sid described blowing up the combat robot to make his getaway. Egan's eyes darted from holo to holo behind Sid's head, but otherwise he was still.
So,
Sid finished,
I need something to fake out the scanners, new ID, and I need it, like, now.
Intense, Egan whispered.
I mean, like, they really branded you?
Sid showed him the metal letters embedded in his forearm. The swelling had gone down, and his skin was healing over the edges. Egan swallowed. He reached out to touch the girl's name. Sid pulled his arm away and rolled the sleeve back down.
So,
he asked,
can you help or what?
Egan put his fingers on his lips.
Hush. Uncle E will make it all better.
He laughed again. Sid sighed. It would be an epic effort to get Egan focused enough to help him, but what choice did he have? He couldn't go back to Mr. Baram's. He didn't want to involve the old man, put his whole business in danger. No way. He'd always been good to Sid. He didn't deserve that. Sid's tweaked friend with the sketchy connections was his only hope.
I can get you anything you need,
Egan told him.
Okay,
Sid urged him.
So, let's have it. Oh, my brother, my foolish, dumb brother,
Egan patted Sid on the back, still laughing.
The party! We have to go to the party! Look, E, I really don't have time for this. I need to get the hell out of this city as fast as I can. Did you not hear me? I'm marked. Sterling Work Colony, I have to get away.
I heard you, Princess. Egan's voice changed. All the tweaked humor drained out of it. And I'm trying to tell you, I can't help you here. My friend at the party, he's the hookup. Well, his friend. Upper City kid. His father is some Securitech executive. He'll take care of you.
I can't go to some upper city party right now. My patron killed a girl, and I just assaulted like a dozen guardians. Oh, Sidney, you childish Chapter 11 chicklet.
The crazy was back in Egan's voice.
Would your old partner in crime ever let you go down without a fight? The Arctic will freeze over first.
He chuckled, then suddenly stood from the couch with a leap.
Now put on your outfit and let's go play with the rich kids. I swear, my guy there will hook you up. To quote the ancient prophet of your people, a DJ's gonna save your life tonight.
13. Arcadia was madness. The young and the beautiful and the wish they were young and the medically beautiful writhed and slithered all over each other. Bathed in the fume, pixelated light of the old warehouse. Images of the ruins of old Detroit flashed on the walls all around, a jungle of steel overgrown with actual jungle. E in Arcadio Ego glowed in neon letters on an antique sign suspended from the ceiling. Knox wondered if it was in some lost language of Detroit. Nine and Simi rushed over to him.
I got a who's who alert on you and I couldn't believe it!
Nine shouted over the rumbling engines, the drum of feet stomping on metal, and the auto-tuned warble of some remixed tween pop star from a century and a half ago.
I can't believe you're here!
Very luxe!
Simi nodded, tapping Knox's glasses. They were heavy black plastic, meant to look like something from the days of moon travel, before people stopped wasting money on that kind of thing. Mission Control, the style was. Knox liked the sound of that. He was in control, on a mission.
We're so happy you have the use of your higher faculties again,
Simi blathered on.
They say there is no greater capacity in man than that of reason and liberty and property as its birthright.
Knox raised his eyebrows at Nine, who just shrugged. Simi wasn't dressed in the right era for the party. He was doing this whole yellow vest and breeches thing with a powdered wig and riding crop. He thought historical reenactment was going to be the next big thing, and he wanted to be on the cutting edge of it. The white powder on his wig shimmered radioactive under the party's effect lighting. It dusted his shoulders like fallout.
"Whatever, Simi," Knox said. "So, Niner, how we rollin'?"
"Oh, it's tight, my friend. We've got this place frozen. Half the kids here paid us to get in one way or another. Those codes you hacked from your dad? Unreal."
"Yeah, well, let's hope they hold out long enough. They'll cycle out of the bloodstream eventually. Tell our customers to avoid peeing too much."
"Peeing?"
Knox just shrugged.
"Where's Cheyenne?" "Oh,